Artificial intelligence is one of the biggest topics in economics and business today. AI researchers are warning about economic change, and the ability to know what skills will be needed in the future seems increasingly cloudy. Regulators are being challenged to think about how to regulate the future of AI. But is this just another hype cycle? To help us make sense of this, I'm joined this episode by author Joshua Ganz. Joshua Ganz is a professor of strategic management and holder of the Jeffrey S. Skoll Chair of Technical Innovation and Entrepreneurship at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto. Joshua is also chief economist at the University of Toronto's Creative Destruction Lab. He's a prolific author, and he explores the intersection of economics and innovation. When Joshua and his co-authors released their book Prediction Machines in 2018, they were writing about a topic that seemed quite niche. At this time, machine learning was just starting out, but in the last year, the speed at which artificial intelligence has advanced has surprised almost everyone. In this conversation, we hear how the analytical framework that he and his colleagues developed helped to make sense of AI. You'll hear why he's optimistic AI will be able to help people remove some of the drudgery from their jobs, but at this time, doesn't seem likely to take over full jobs. He'll share how understanding AI as an advance in predictive statistics helps leaders understand how and where AI may or may not be useful. I'm Michael Bassett, and this is Bright Future, a Conference Board of Canada podcast. Joshua, welcome to Bright Future.
Thanks for having me.
Joshua, the first version of your book, Prediction Machines, came out in 2018. And then it was revised only 4 years later in 2022. What were the big changes in the world of AI that caused you to update that book?
The decision was really, we were writing a sequel to Prediction Machines called Power and Prediction, which was really the bit that took what we had started there in Prediction Machines and built on it. The Prediction Machines book itself, we thought, well, this would be a good opportunity. It's been 5 years. We should have a look at what we wrote and update it accordingly, because this is a very rapid moving area. Actually, as it turned out, there were very few bits that we actually had to update within the text of the original book. We had to become a little less optimistic about getting self-driving cars and things like that. We had to take some companies out that passed by the wayside in the meantime. But other than that, we just added some topics that we thought that we hadn't explored in depth enough, in particular about which decisions are more consequential than other decisions and how to recognize that. That's really all we did. I must say that we put both that updated version and the new book out in November of 2022. And on the 30th of November 2022, that's when ChatGPT was released. Now, had we known what was going to occur there, I suspect we would have added different parts to both of those books to take that into account. But obviously, sometimes these things happen.
Well, it seems to be the challenge writing about artificial intelligence these days. It's moving so quickly. Let's talk about that. In the last year, there have been all of these newly released AI tools that have been released to the whole world. Do you think the assessment that you made of the power of these tools to enable predictive behaviors is coming true? Do you feel validated by what you're seeing, or do you think it's changing your assessments of where these might go?
Actually, and I mean, it's always a bit of bias and own justification to say this, but actually this is along the path that we had expected. It's a bit quicker than what we might have expected, but it's the same path. Our original basic mojo is to say all these advances in artificial intelligence are all advances in prediction. That is, taking information you have and creating it into information that you need or want. In the case of these GPT technologies, these large language models and other things like that, they're prediction machines. What the surprise was, how well they would do at this juncture in 2022. I don't think anybody, including a lot of AI scientists, thought that what OpenAI would do would yield such a useful set of tools so quickly. In that respect, yes, it's along what we expected. But no, I don't think ourselves or anybody else had anticipated this rapid improvement this quickly.
I'm going to ask you to unpack what you mean by predictive machines. You're talking about how AI is akin to a prediction machine. And the most important ways of thinking about AI in this way, maybe giving some examples that best would illustrate either the economic or the business changes that come when you start to think about artificial intelligence as a prediction tool.
One of the things that we noticed 10 years ago, when all of these things called artificial intelligence were sort of coming to the fore, is that they weren't necessarily the artificial intelligence that you'd have in popular culture, the robots that can do super reasoning and things like that. Instead, when we looked under the hood, as a lot of people did, these were advances in machine learning. Machine learning, as it turns out, and the things that have been going on there, are really just advances in statistics. They're better statistical methods, they're better ways of computing statistical outcomes from very, very large data sets. In that respect, our job, as we saw it, was to take this incredibly interesting concept of artificial intelligence that would provoke so many emotions and strip it out and make it as boring and unsexy as possible. And that is basically what we did. If you want to have cold water poured on all of this, our book Prediction Machines is for you. And we did that for a very, very important reason. Obviously not for sales. But we did that because we were very much worried about the hype. We get hype cycles in technologies all the time. We've seen this again and again, and hype tends to lead to people saying, oh, we need to catch up very quickly, we need to do this and that, and spending a lot of money on things that don't bear any fruit. This was important here as well. We had to strip AI down to what it really was so that people could work out if they really needed it. And what it really was just a statistical advance in prediction. And now we all know about those sorts of things. We get it from, you know, weather forecasts of that. They take information that we have, past readings of weather as well as current readings, and they convert it into information that we need. What's the weather going to be like later today, tomorrow, or next week? That's a familiar prediction. And there are businesses who engage in predictions all the time. For instance, banks and credit card companies will spend a lot of time trying to predict whether a particular transaction might be fraudulent or not. If it's fraudulent, they want to stop it. If it's not fraudulent, they want to let it go. Getting that right is important because you want convenience, but then again, you don't want people having trouble if their credit cards are stolen. That's normal stock standard prediction. And in fact, a lot of the initial applications of AI were doing that. But then they could do more complicated things, things that in your ordinary course of life, you didn't think of as prediction. For instance, if there's an image, what's in that image? It's not that you present an AI with a picture of a dog and it's sort of looking like, ah, look at that. There's nose and there's a tongue and there's ears and there's four legs. And so it's a dog. You could do that. But that's not what these do. What they do is they say, what would a person who trained me as the AI say this is likely to be a dog? So in other words, I'm coming up with a label that predicts what you think it would be, what a person thinks it would be, rather than some fundamental essence of a dog. It's really just a lot of statistics. And obviously, if you feed enough pictures of dogs and a picture of things that are not dogs, then you're going to be able to tell statistically whether a given picture is likely to be a dog. And the interesting thing about that, and this is very important, is it doesn't take the picture as a whole. It chunks it up into little bits. And then it combines those things to form this prediction. It's more computation than we can sort of conceive of in thinking about how to predict things, but this is what it's doing. And the reason that's very important, because when it came to these large language models like ChatGPT, they did essentially the same thing. What those were just advances in predictive text. And we're very familiar with predictive text. Our iPhones would never have worked if they didn't use predictive text to guess which key we're actually pressing with our thumbs. It wasn't like the old BlackBerry where the BlackBerry knew. These things sort of get it wrong all the time, but what is going on under the hood is a correction and saying, what was this person likely to be hitting when they reach for an E or whatever? One way of thinking about these large language models is that they're autocorrect on steroids. They're just another version of that. When they're behaving very well, you think, wow, that is amazing what they can do. But then you sometimes pick up some funny things. And some funny things, once you realize, oh, it's autocorrect, oh, no wonder it did that. There was a person, a journalist, who spent a couple of hours chatting with ChatGPT or one of its variants. An hour into the conversation, somehow this moved on to the ChatGPT trying to convince this fellow to leave his wife. And you sort of think, oh, no, look what it did there. And now if you put any intent on that, it looks like, oh, that's really weird. But if you think about it from a predictive point of view, what do you think was going on? What was going on is this AI had been trained probably on a corpus of romance and other similar novels. And all of a sudden, the conversation veered into that territory and it picked up on that and went basically tropey on that issue. That's what really was going on. It was nothing creepy when you think about it from prediction point of view. That's really important because basically when given a new technology and thinking about what it should be able to do, we know fundamentally these AIs have to obey certain laws, the laws of statistics. There's only so much you can do. Statistics doesn't perform miracles. If you've taken any statistic courses, most of it's devoted to all of the pitfalls that can occur. Those pitfalls also apply to AI, which is one of the reasons why the people who are best able to implement and start to use AI are those who are data scientists and are trained in statistics. And then it goes beyond that after that.
One of the examples in the book that I've used in talking to people about it is this concept of the retailer that shifts from shop then ship to a ship then shop model. The examples you provided are where we are, but that felt like where we're going, that example.
Once you understand that this is just an advance in prediction, you can start getting futuristic about it. Instead of saying, oh, well, this is a good tool, this is what it does, I'll accept that. You're trying to say, well, where's the, in the hockey metaphor, where's the puck going to be? Because that's where I want to skate to. So what you do is you take the dial on that prediction. You take the dial on its quality and how cheap it is and other things, and you dial it up number 10 or 11 or whatever you want. And you say, ah, well, if this prediction machine was so good, it could do something, what would that do to my business? And so the example we give is recommendation engines that, for instance, Amazon uses. When you're shopping, it recommends things to you. Some of those recommendations are based on what you happen to be searching for, but others are perhaps based on your past shopping behavior, your past preferences and things like that. You can sort of say, oh, I wonder what would happen if that got really good. I wonder if Amazon could look at all my purchase history and recommend exactly what I want to buy right now. And you say, oh, well, that's something it could do. But you say, I wonder if that would lead to some transformation in the way we do this whole system of getting stuff to us. For instance, if Amazon knows what I want, do I have to really log in, search for it, click, and then have it shipped to me? What if it just turned up at my door? What if I open the door one day and there's an Amazon box and I look and open and say, oh, toothpaste, I was just about to run out of that. If Amazon did that right now, most of the stuff would be, oh, I don't need this. And so we'd have to take it back and there'd be waste, there'd be complications. But if it was perfect, as I said, this is a exercise. If it was perfect, then why not? It just turns up for you. It works and you say, oh, great, I don't even have to think about that. Oh, I forgot I was going to need that. Oh, I did need that. It's getting ahead of you. That could be a whole different business model. And if it's doing it well enough, you can imagine how that could change the way in which it ships things to you and stocks and all those sorts of things. It would run right through the organization. We did that because that was something we could understand. We're not experts in anything other than economics, so we go where we understand. And we just did the simple exercise of taking something that was being predicted, making it perfect, and saying, what would that mean for the business? And that's really the exercise that in our book we're encouraging everybody to do. There's a lot involved once you do that, but that's the starting point. And it doesn't mean tomorrow you'll be able to go and implement that. Obviously, Amazon doesn't even have that prediction yet. But you can say, well, is it going that way? Are they going to be able to do that? Can we do that? If we push to do it, would we do it? And then what would things look like if we did? Is that worthwhile going to?
I think that's such a great example of this other concept that you talk about in the book around how the rise of AI is really presenting society with many choices. And many of those choices, you argue, are trade-offs. You juxtapose productivity versus distribution, innovation versus competition, and performance versus privacy. What's your assessment of the choices we're making today in each of those trade-offs?
Right at the moment, there is simultaneously a lot of hype about AI, and there's an unprecedented amount of fear. And the reason why the fear is not justified right now is that the AI just simply isn't good enough to realize those fears. We might be concerned that with the use of sufficient data and artificial intelligence, even if you weren't saying things privately about yourselves, AI might be able to surface them and then use that information and worse, use that information against you and things like that. That's a trade-off between better AI and things that would be privacy concerns. And there was an old story from a few years ago, which I'm never 100% sure once these things get into the debate how true it actually was, of a target who was using some sort of predictive engine, ended up sending coupons for baby gear and things that you have for a baby to a family. It turned out that one of the teenage daughters in the family was pregnant, and somehow the shopping behavior of that person in Target had triggered this stuff, and her parents didn't know, and obviously that wasn't good. That's the sort of thing we have privacy for. Those are the sorts of things that stoke those fears and trade-offs. But right now, there's still a tremendous amount of uncertainty about where AI is going to be most applicable and really start to impact on people. And there's huge amount of uncertainty with regard to jobs that it might transform. There's a sort of belief that it's going to transform some jobs. It's maybe going to transform more jobs. What does that mean? You know, we've lived through these before. Computers did it. The internet did it. These clearly transformed our jobs. That's a different question as to whether our jobs get worse or they disappear. Historically, that hasn't been the case. There are some industries that get very disrupted by new technologies, and so there is some reorganization, but widespread unemployment hasn't been a thing we've seen. People say, well, AI is doing what people do. It's thinking, how will we be able to compete against these machines? And then you have to step back and say, well, okay, maybe in the future someone will work out how to do that. What we have right now is just prediction. It's just a prediction thing. And that's one aspect of intelligence. And you normally apply that prediction with other things that are very more uniquely human. Something that we call judgment, and I can go into that.
We should talk about that because you do draw this distinction between the components of human labor, human value that you see will diminish in value in the coming years, and those that you see as increasing in value. And you talk about power prediction, which is something the machine is good at and will get much better at, certainly than humans, you argue. But then there is that question of this judgment, data, and action, the three concepts that you think are really those elements that are fundamentally human that will continue to provide value. A lot of business leaders are hearing the hype. They are being asked by their boards, what are they supposed to be doing about AI? How are you projecting it? They're developing plans. What's the advice that you would give to someone who is looking at their business in the next 3 to 5 years, trying to determine what are the kinds of investments in talent and technology and business processes that are going to be needed to help them stay ahead of this and make the right choices where the value of the tool will increase and where the value of the humans will increase?
It all comes down to this word automation. Fundamentally, if you're going to take someone's job and replace it with a machine, what you are basically saying is that this machine can do this job and maybe with some benefits and other things that you might as a business leader, well, now I don't have to worry about working conditions and an HR department and all this sort of stuff, and it starts to get to look attractive. But then you have to say to yourself, can I really automate what they do? And I'll give you an example. When we were talking about self-driving cars, which was a thing that would come, much of what driving is prediction. And the reason why I say that is you look at somebody doing something in front of you in a car and you have to decide, do you stop, do you go, etc. The hard part is assessing what they're doing. The easy part is knowing what to do with that information. One of the reasons we felt like we could fully automate a car is because the judgment part was easy. Everybody agrees that if the car in front of you is stopping, you should stop. There's no like debate about that. When you look at a weather forecast and you see that the probability of rain is 60%, different people are going to have different answers as to whether they should take an umbrella or not. They're not disagreeing about the probability, but they're disagreeing about what that means for their decision. But when it comes to driving a car, there's very little of that. It's all codifiable. It's easy to get around. So you look at that and you say, ah, well, if you're a driver, surely we'll be able to make these machines that can just do better than you, last longer, they won't get tired, they won't have to go to the bathroom, all of those things. But then you start to think about, okay, so what if we did that? One of the examples given was, oh, these self-driving cars are going to be much safer. We should have self-driving school buses. That would seem like a good thing to do. I mean, it's a funny sort of job. It's only up during certain parts of the day and it's tied to the bus. Why not have a self-driving school bus? And you only have to think for a few seconds before you find out some issues associated with that. A bus shows up and your kid gets on. There's no driver on the bus. What else isn't there on that bus? The adult. The only person on that bus previously that was an adult was the driver. Are you going to put your kid on a bus without an adult? And you start to think, well, that's not a good idea. Don't want to leave these kids to fend for themselves on the way to school. All manner of things would occur. And so you want an adult in the room. You want somebody there. All of a sudden, your driver, whose cost you're trying to eliminate from your budget, has to be replaced by an adult whose job it is not to drive, but to actually supervise the children. Now, that's all very well. In fact, it's easier to supervise children if you're not driving than when you are driving, so that you're getting a better product for that. But, you know, essentially the salary of that person's much the same. So you've invested all this capital in a self-driving bus, and you actually still have a person to employ, because it turned out that driving wasn't the only thing being done. You can see this also happening with truck driving, these long haul things. There's no kids involved there. Why not there? Well, there you start to think, oh, there really is a role in the driver in protecting the load. If you let a self-driving truck drive for 1,000 kilometers or more, people could get wind of that and they could stop these things. And worse, it's really easy to stop these things because these self-driving vehicles are going to have all sorts of safety precautions. So stopping them is like child's play. And then all of a sudden, they're not secure. And all of a sudden, you realize, oh, no, somebody does have to go with this thing. I can't quite eliminate that job. However, maybe that person becomes far more productive as a result. Maybe that person could be in charge of 3 trucks, not one. Maybe that person could sleep while these things occurred, and maybe that would be better for this stuff. It becomes far more complicated than you think. In other words, taking a full-on job and completely automating it is really, really quite challenging to do. And I think that was always the case with normal machines, not just prediction machines. In that regard, it's almost better to forget about doing that and to basically say, I have the stock of people that I'm currently working. How can I use AI to automate the bits of their jobs that are hard, routine, boring, so that they can spend their time on things that are more value creating. And the job satisfaction goes up, everything goes up, no one's really fearing being replaced. It's as if I've given my employees better tools.
What has surprised you about how businesses or business leaders have reacted in the last 12 months to this AI explosion and the discussions that have happened?
One of the surprises was the amount of fear involved. And I think much of that fear is misplaced due to the quality of the artificial intelligence available. The other surprise has been that it's built up yet another hype cycle. I thought we'd already had our AI hype cycle 5 years ago. We were in this stage where we were sort of like saying, geez, I don't know if this AI is really working out for us as quickly as possible, which is one of the reasons we wrote our book, Power and Prediction, was basically saying, people are spending a lot of money on AI and not getting the fruits of it. And we suggested, well, you can use AI to improve certain tools and little things and stuff like that. But real transformational stuff, that takes time. It took time with electricity, etc. I feel that right now with this new hype cycle, people are seeing transformation all over the place. Some of that belief is quite justified. I mean, if you're a computer programmer, these tools have been tremendous for you in terms of taking away a lot of the drudgery of computer coding and building them up. If you happen to be in the business of writing a lot of boring, perfunctory emails, this is great for you too. This is like taking away those sorts of things. Most of that is going to lead to some sort of existential crisis where we wonder, why were we sending these things in the first place? My favorite example being if someone's got some bullet points, they ask AI to put it into a proper email. They send the email to another person. The person looks at the email and says, well, I could read that, or I could ask the AI to just put them into bullet points. And so you have to ask yourself, not only has the AI doesn't seem to be productive in that instance, was anyone productive in that instance? All of a sudden, it's exposing no one was doing what was useful. In terms of surprise, I'm surprised that we've had such an advance so quickly, that we've seen so much interest occur. We are in the dangers of another hype cycle with regard to that. And some of that has been playing out recently. There's been some discussions, for instance, that it costs OpenAI an enormous amount just to run ChatGPT. After enough days, that really starts to add up, especially when we remember that OpenAI is just a startup at the moment. And so people say, well, is this really sustainable? Is all this sustainable? My view for that is no, not for the normal sort of ChatGPT type thing, although that turns out to be a very good interface. What really these foundational new models of AI are doing is they're setting the basis for a whole lot of applications. The value in AI over the next few years is going to be that we're going to see a lot of applications driven by AI doing things that were not previously done, and they're using as their engine these foundational models. It's not necessarily, oh, how do we use these models? That's not even quite the right question. In fact, for a lot of businesses, they don't want to use those models because you're putting your memos and other information onto some system and no one's offering any guarantees of what happens to that information. Instead, what you should be asking yourselves is, okay, now that we've got these sorts of technologies, what applications would be of use to us? If the applications are just use to your business alone, you can develop them yourselves. If the applications are likely to be of use to many, many businesses, you should be on the lookout for those arising so that you can adopt them. None of that's going to necessarily transform any of the current businesses. But in fact, the productivity increases could still be quite large by being able to put these new applications throughout the organization. And especially for service organizations, it's notoriously difficult to squeeze out productivity increases in service organizations, not like manufacturing or farming. Service is very difficult, but this is where that may come into play.
So you've talked hype cycle, you've talked about pouring cold water on the excitement around AI. Where are you as an investment-minded individual? Do you think AI is overvalued today? Do you think it's undervalued?
It's really difficult to say. There's uncertainty, so some places under and some places overvalued, for sure. You know, I've sat there for a better part of a decade looking at these AI developments at the Creative Destruction Lab here at Toronto and elsewhere. We continue to see great strides occurring in that. Most of the stuff that seems very, very interesting at the moment are advances in health and medical devices, health-related technologies. That both tells you what is great about AI and also what is terrible about AI, potentially from a business investment perspective. The problem with these health-related innovations is prediction is the heart of a lot of medical decision-making, absolutely diagnosis being one example. And AI can dramatically help that occur, make diagnosis easy, cheap, more widely available, etc. But the question then becomes what you do with that diagnosis. You have to have some treatment options. You know, it's going to require some people to sign off on that. To work out if those treatment options combined with this new AI lead to better outcomes than whatever was occurring before requires trials. So you have to test it. Then also, there are existing ways of doing things. You're suggesting handing some functions over to a machine. There are a lot of people in the medical community who are distrustful of that and want to understand what is going on. There are resistance to adopting it. You have the Hippocratic Oath, which gets taken in this mean to do no harm. Well, do no harm relative to what? It's a bit of perspective. If I told you, if you're going to adopt a new technique or a new technology, you want the new one to be better than the old one. If I frame it the other way and saying, well, the new one is on average better than the old one, wouldn't it be negligent not to adopt the new one? You struggle because you don't know how to trade off the cases where it does work better and the cases where it doesn't work better and being able to do that. And that slows everything down in terms of adoption. Then you've got governments who have to approve these devices. Then you've got insurers who have to decide to pay for these sorts of things, which may or may not be cheaper than before once it's all said and done. You see those barriers turning up. What this is saying is that advances in AI are great, but improving decision-making, and decision-making has a context, has a whole lot of things around it, a whole lot of things we've done, that can slow all of this down. From an investment perspective, you need to not just look at how well the AI is performing. That's obviously job one. If it's not performing, who cares? But you also have to say, okay, can we get this to market? What are the processes involved? So in other words, you're not done yet. There is more work to be done in a lot of these situations. There's a tendency to see the bright light of the tool in front of you doing its job without any constraints, and then looking at all the other things that need to happen for this thing to be commercialized. Now, this isn't new. This happens for every technology. But what worries me is that people are forgetting that part. Or if they're not forgetting it, they're sort of throwing a lot of money at a lot of things and hoping some will just randomly overcome these.
You're a trained economist. The economics profession is known as the dismal science. You've been talking a little bit about pouring some cold water on stuff. But what we're seeing in the artificial intelligence space is this very, very strong reaction from AI researchers who have dedicated their entire lives to this and are looking at the last 12 months and saying, I'm scared of the speed that this is happening. I'm scared that the impact this is going to have. Fewer people are being on that optimistic side, but there are those that are also saying, as these things move forward, they're going to be increasingly smarter. Humanity will be able to solve many of, if not all, of our challenges. And where do you position yourself when you think, you know, I have a sense from our conversation so far, but where are you on that spectrum of doomsday to optimist? And what would you say to the opposite side on why you're making that assessment?
As you would guess from my answers thus far, I'm on the optimistic side. I believe that the advances, especially over the last year or so, have been just fantastic. I use them myself. This is what we were looking for coming out of this. I'm very much an optimist. I'm an optimist in terms of what the impact of this technology is going to be, certainly in the short term. I'm less enthusiastic about, is the technology good enough yet to really do some stuff? And I think there's more to happen there. But the other side of it is like, okay, you know, this stuff is happening. It's happening at a rapid rate. How should we change our assessment, our own forecast, if you will, that lends us to fear or promote this as the case may be? There are a couple of reactions to that. You know, one is like, I think it's legitimate to say, oh, you know, these people developed this AI and they seemed surprised, scared, etc. It's useful to find out why. To unpack exactly why. So I'm less convinced when they start talking about things that are economic expertise, like precisely what it would do, jobs, labor market inequality, all those things. For all their brilliance in AI, they're not trained in that part of it. They're still engineers. Engineers tend to think about automation. They tend to think their technologies are very, very good. So Jeff Hinton, a few years ago at a conference that we set up, said that with respect to AI, we should stop training all the radiologists now. And what he was saying is that whatever radiologists do, we've fixed that. No need to train them anymore. I don't think a single radiologist has lost their job. I don't think a single radiology student has had trouble being hired since that time. You have to ask yourself what's going on. I look at that and say, that's the point. The radiologist is probably doing a lot more than what the machines would do. And then Jeff Hinton comes out the other side of that and sees some of the new advances, which are even better than the advances he was basing his initial prediction on, and says, oh, this is now going into all sorts of other areas. I'm worried about everybody's jobs. I'm worried about everybody's things now. My view of that is that I think this reflects an issue, is that as these prediction end machines get very, very good, not even the scientists fully understand why they're performing so well. So I can say, it's like enhanced autocorrect as a way of trying to get my handle around it. But sometimes what these things do seems better than that. I'm sure if somehow we could do an audit of this, we could come to realize, it was still just prediction all along, because it feels like that's the case. The concern is that it's becoming good and that people are going to use it not just simply to review this email and send it off. They're going to automate all that. And then all of a sudden, these AIs were predicting something that will be used by another AI and so on and so forth. And you can imagine a situation in which bad things occur as a result of chaining all that together. There's this cautious element because we don't really understand what's going on. And I think there's something to that idea. I think in a lot of applications we're currently using, it doesn't matter. But I think we could face situations where that occurs. And in fact, I get a little more worried about the AI researchers these days who are like, there's no problem we can't fix. In the past, when things haven't worked out well, we've fixed them. It's all going to be fine. You know, that's all very well. But I've also seen that happen before. For instance, everybody seems to indicate that we wouldn't have the climate change issues we had now had we switched to and kept developing nuclear power. And we know all the arguments to get nuclear power. But there hasn't been a new nuclear reaction in the United States since Three Mile Island. If things go wrong because we don't fully understand it, there is an easy likelihood that you can have an overreaction. And we're seeing some of that occur in AI at the moment. Like things are going and don't really understand it. And so all of a sudden, there are restrictions being poured on. And I already said earlier what those restrictions meant in like the medical industry for the adoption of these things. What if they spread even further than that? My concern is that if you have engineers developing AI that are not concerned about some of these effects, then we will have some bad effects and we'll get a overreaction and slow down and throw out the baby with the bathwater. And we've done this before. That is my principal concern. I'm optimistic. I don't have the fear of these things. But then again, part of me realizes there could be some bad events that occur. And we could get the overreaction we've got that people argue with, like nuclear power. We've got some of these things going on with cryptocurrency at the moment. We're still standing in these TSA lines for hours. It's not out of the realms of possibility that fear translates into a reaction that's an overreaction, and we could miss out on a lot.
What is your reaction to the regulation discussion?
I think we don't yet know. We haven't yet diagnosed the illness. It's okay to worry, think about regulation when you don't know how to regulate. If you've convinced yourself that there is a problem and then you search for solutions to it. But we haven't diagnosed the illness. Even if we can speculate on some of those things, we of course don't know how to deal with them. The issue is, what regulations? One of the big problems we face is exactly the problem I started out with, is that defining AI is very difficult. Ted Chiang, a science fiction writer, said, what is the definition of AI? AI is a poorly chosen set of words from the 1950s. And that's really the problem we face right now. If we regulated AI as it currently is, we're going to be regulating these statistical techniques. Where would we draw the line there? Can't do that either. Some of the more sensible ideas, maybe more sensible, is coming up with ways of assessing whether a AI model or statistical model is safe or not. And that at least sort of feels like, yes, of course, we'd like to have these things safe before they get released at scale. It's not clear that that's a current problem we face, because businesses who are releasing AI would also like them to be safe because they're going to bear the consequences of that. So it's not sure that that's a regulatory problem as much as something just to be aware of. But I think actually ultimately that if you're really worried about the super dangerous stuff with respect to AI, it is probably important to ensure that we bet on more horses in this race. AI, you know, over the past decade has been subject to all sorts of little mini explosions in activity. There was first deep learning, then there was supervised learning, then there was unsupervised learning, then there was generative AI, then there's generative adversarial networks and other things like that. All sorts of different things. You see in the scientific community on AI, there's tremendous enthusiasm and focus on going one path or another. One suspects there's too little work being done on the paths that are being set aside. And those paths may not offer fruits as quickly, but may be more robust from a safety point of view in the long run. If I had my druthers, you wouldn't be thinking about regulating AI as it currently is. You'd be saying, oh, we need to get back to the basic science. We need to fund basic science on all the different approaches to these sorts of things so that we have options in the future should we find out that the approach everybody's currently using turns out to have some dangers with it. It was much in the same way as we needed to invest in light water nuclear reactors as well as heavy water nuclear reactors, but they only did one sort. And if they'd had a more diverse research program, there may have been more options available there.
When you look at this space and you think about the economic trends that you're going to be looking for to start to see if AI is actually starting to have that impact on the economy, on jobs, it's not here now, but what are the things that you're looking at or you will be looking at as statistical indicators that the economy may be changing and that our world is being influenced by the rise of these tools, more than just the hype?
We have unemployment runs usually around between 4% to 10% in a major recession. That's the range of these things. If AI or anything else was having an impact, we would start to see the unemployment rate persistently at much higher levels. And we'd start to notice that and start to wonder why. And then we might do the same thing as you would do in sort of regions and say, well, why is there in certain regions more unemployment than others? And you'll say, well, look, these big factories closed down. Or it could be that people are no longer using people in call centers or something like that. And you'll see these sorts of trends start to occur. The real issue is not if they occur in a sort of slow moving way. The real issue is whether for some years, over just a few years, all of a sudden you a whole lot of businesses changing over and starting to shed workers in large degrees. And it occurred very, very quickly. We know you can even cope with that for a time because we did that during the pandemic. That would be what we would be looking for. And right at the moment, we're seeing no signs of such things at all going on. I again remain optimistic. We will tell. If it turns out that AI is destroying a lot of jobs, we will see a lot of jobs destroyed, and that will show up in the data. These economies are big ones, but we can see these trends. I don't think it's going to just take us by surprise and we're going to look around all day and say, everybody seems to be out of work.
You've talked about being an optimist about this, about the opportunity it may have. Where would you want AI to focus in terms of problems or challenges or areas where you think the power of this tool coupled with good judgment and effectiveness could actually create some really meaningful changes for the country or for the world?
Yeah, I'm going to disappoint you with this answer. That's a bad question. And the reason why it's a bad question is that we don't really know. The one thing we know about AI is that it is a general purpose technology that seems to have applications in all sorts of areas. And in the past, any individual, just speculating without any skin in the game, has no particular insight over any other individual. What we will see is that some people have beliefs and will pursue them and innovate on them, and they will turn out to be, in retrospect, where AI had the most value. But right at this moment, that can be anyone. That's bad for me, who wants to make for an interesting podcast, and bad for you, of course, as well. But it's very good in terms for people who really want to build on these technologies. Your idea is no worse or no better from my perspective than anybody else's. But if you have some insight, there's an opportunity there to pursue.
Joshua, it's been a great discussion. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Bright Future from the Conference Board of Canada. If you like what you hear, you can leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Let us know how we're doing. The views expressed by our guests are theirs alone and do not reflect the Conference Board's research or opinion. For more podcasts, research, commentary, and ideas, visit conferenceboard.ca.